between 2002 and 2009. The problem leads to an estimated 1 million emergency room visits a year, and it's the leading cause of injury death in 17 states. Joining me in the studio to talk about the use and abuse of prescription pain medication, Dr. Paul Christo of Johns Hopkins University Hospital, and Dr. Nora Volkoff of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. We are going to open the phones, take your calls, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to join us on Facebook or send us a tweet. Joining us by phone from Rockville, Maryland, Dr. Robert DuPont. He's president of the Institute for Behavior and Health. Good morning, Dr. DuPont. You and I haven't seen each other for a while.
But I've been listening to you practically every day since that time, and I'm thrilled to be on the program.
I'm so glad to have you with us. Give us your sense of the scope of the problem as it exists now.
Well, I consider it the defining drug problem of the 21st century. The idea that prescription drugs would cause as many emergency room visits as all illegal drugs put together is just staggering. Another statistic that I find remarkable is in my lifetime, I thought I'd never see any drug that was used more commonly or initiation was used more commonly than marijuana. In 2009, we had 2.4 million people who first used marijuana and 2.6 million who first used a prescription drug illegally.
I gather you regard it as even worse than the crack epidemic back in the 1980s.
Yes, the crack epidemic was sudden and so dramatic. This is building more slowly, but it's much larger. And the potentials for death in particular are way beyond anything we saw then. You know, a prescription pain medicine, a one-day dose can be sold on the black market for $100, and a single dose is lethal to a non-patient. There is no other medicine that has those characteristics. And if you think about that combination and the millions of people who are using these medicines, you get some idea of the exposure of the society to the prescription drug problem.
And talk about the Obama administration's new proposal to curb prescription painkiller addiction.
I think it is historic. What Gil Kierlikowski did on Tuesday when he announced this plan was lay out a path forward. He took the various government agencies that were all confronting the problem and brought them together and showed them a path and got our country on a path to deal with the problem. So I think that was a historic development with the four-part plan that he put forward. So I'm very optimistic, very impressed with that. What I think is missing, however, is the realization that this is just a toe in the water. This is a down payment on a national effort that's going to be prolonged and is going to cause the whole country, including doctors and patients, to rethink and make changes in how we handle prescription medicines, especially the opiates.
And that is the voice of Dr. Robert DuPont. He's president of the Institute for Behavior and Health. Turning to you, Dr. Christo, how do you see it as a drop in the bucket or truly beginning to address this problem?
You know, I think many of us who treat patients who have acute pain and especially chronic pain applaud the efforts of the Obama administration in terms of essentially decreasing the supply of opioids that are on the market. However, I mean, I just don't want us to miss sight of the huge problem that exists right now in terms of persistent pain. I mean, there are some estimates that the prevalence of pain reaches 100 million people, almost a third of the population. So while I applaud the efforts, and I'm concerned too of the basically the rates of non-medical use of prescription opioids and the deaths associated with that, my concern is that it's going to lead to further undertreatment of pain.
Here's my concern, and turning to you, Dr. Volkov, to ask you about this. People do become, as Dr. Christou has pointed out, sort of torn up by pain. What can they do besides getting involved with these kinds of drugs that deal with pain? If they haven't got anything else out there, what can they do?
You're putting your finger in the difficulty and challenge of this epidemic, which we had not had for other drugs. These drugs, when used properly, can be life-saving for patients that suffer from pain, whereas when diverted, they can actually be lethal. And so we are challenged by this epidemic on the one hand. We do not want to curtail proper treatment of those that need them. At the same time, we cannot close our eyes of the devastating consequences the increased availability of these medications has made with respect to diversion and abuse. So what is it where we are? I think that in looking at it critically, objectively, I can say that we really know very little about chronic pain. And also, if you look at how we are dealing with it, we're actually addressing chronic pain almost as if it were acute pain than many days. So we treat it as with similar medications, except for long periods of time. So while opioid analgesics are very useful, we have to recognize that we've been using them the same way, basically almost like we used them 50 years ago. And we really do not have medications that that divert from those that could be transforming on the way that we deal with chronic pain. Moreover, we have very few studies that have actually evaluated the efficacy of opioid analgesics, which are the ones that are abused, in chronic situations. There are very few randomized trials, so we don't even really even know how effective they are for the management of chronic pain. So in your question, what should we be doing? Well, to start with, we should be doing more research that addresses the need for better treatments of patients suffering from chronic gut pain.
Dr. Nora Volkov, she's director of the NIH's National Institute on Drug Abuse, here in the studio as well. Dr. Paul Christou, he's director of the Multidisciplinary Pain Fellowship Program at the Johns Hopkins University Hospital and director of the Pain Treatment Center there. He's host of Aches and Gains, a weekly radio show in Baltimore. On the line with us is Robert DuPont. He's president of the Institute for Behavior and Health, former director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. I can see that many of you have already phoned in. It's clear chronic pain is a problem for so many people. So the problem becomes, Dr. DuPont, how one manages pain without becoming addicted to the drug which is used to treat that pain.
You know, Diane, I think that the use of the medicines by patients who are using the medicines as directed by their physicians, who are not also using other drugs that their physicians don't know about, is very safe. And I think Dr. Christou was mentioning that. I don't think anything we're talking about should discourage anyone from using these medicines to treat pain.
What medicines are we talking about, Dr. DuPont?
We're talking about opiate analgesics that are modeled on the experience with morphine, but have now become primarily synthetic analogs that have the same basic effect on pain, medicine like Vicodin, for example, and OxyContin would be examples, but there are literally hundreds. And this class of medicines has become the most widely prescribed class of medicines in the United States, surpassing all the other areas for high blood pressure and high cholesterol and anxiety. It's remarkable that we have now more pain medicines prescribed than any of these other categories of prescription drugs. But I want to go back to the point. The key is we need to have these medicines kept within the medical system, and what has to happen is people have to be aware of the fact that there are people who appear to be pain patients, but who are using these medicines in an entirely different, abusive, addictive way, and who are selling these medicines. And we've got people who are casually passing the medicines on to other people and leaving the medicines around so they are stolen, taken by teenagers, so it becomes an initiating drug for teenagers. What has to happen is to close the system more effectively so the medicines are used by the patients for whom they're prescribed, and they are not diverted into situations where they are really dangerous. For those patients, it's good. For others, it's lethal.
Dr. Christo.
Those are great points, and I agree with you, Dr. DuPont. Further, I would say, you know, there's such a great variability in pain education among physicians, and that's one of the problems that we struggle with. So, I mean, I think that there are estimates that only 5% of those who suffer from pain actually see a pain specialist. Therefore, most patients are seeing primary care physicians who are on the front lines and who lack the education necessary to do what you're talking about, essentially to ensure the safety of the use of prescription opioids for patients who have pain.
Dr. Paul Christo, he's at the Johns Hopkins University Hospital and former director of the Blaustein Pain Treatment Center. Short break. We'll be right back.
Take a road trip this spring courtesy of Zipcar, the world's largest car sharing service. Donate your car in April to receive a Zipcar membership and driving credit. Call 866-WAMU-444 or visit WAMU.org for details.
This program of the Diane Rehm Show was recorded earlier, so we're not able to take new phone calls. But we welcome your comments at drshow.org or join us on Facebook.
And welcome back. We're talking about a problem that is growing rapidly in this country, and that is addiction to pain medications. Here in the studio, Dr. Nora Volkoff, she's director of the NIH's National Institute on Drug Abuse, Dr. Paul Christo at Johns Hopkins University Hospital, and Dr. Robert DuPont is on the line with us. He's president of the Institute for Behavior and Health, former director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Dr. Volkoff, you want to make a comment?
Yes, I wanted to make a comment to from Dr. Christo's perspective in terms of education, but because it is very accurate in terms of the fact that medical students and healthcare professionals that are going to be prescribing opioid medications do not appear to have the proper training. And there's been a survey to try to actually evaluate the amount of pain education that medical students get in the United States. And in average, most schools will provide that, courses that mention pain in 5 to 10 weeks throughout the whole training. And that is in contrast to what you will see in the veterinary schools, where you actually see sevenfold higher exposure to the treatment of pain in animals. So it's clear that we do not have sufficient education regarding screening and treatment of pain in general medical school teaching. And the same may be true for pharmacy as well as nursing. And in the meantime, there's been significant advances of our knowledge about pain for one side. There's been a wide variety of different types of ways of prescribing opioid medications, and we've learned a lot about what substance abuse and addiction is. So there is a need to really increase the curriculum on the education of how to screen and manage pain.
All right, here's an email from Phoenix, Maryland, that sort of puts the finger on the whole issue. Andrea says, I've suffered with persistent pain for 35 years. Without prescription medications, my life would not be worth living. I applaud efforts by manufacturers, law enforcement, and advocacy groups to make the public aware that we have to solve the diversion problem without trampling the rights of those who need it to live a somewhat normal life. The addiction rate among patients who are properly monitored is extremely low, and there is not a euphoric effect. Dr. Christo, is that your experience?
That's a great email, and it summarizes, I think, my general experience with patients that I treat who have persistent pain and who are using what we're talking about, sort of long-acting or sustained-release opioids. I mean, you know, our goal is to ensure that they use these medications properly, safely. We monitor them. We ensure that they come up with therapeutic goals. And I have many patients who use opioids who are quite functional, who work part-time or full-time. But, I mean, it's our, as a physician's, responsibility to produce the guidelines, to monitor patients, and to develop a trustful therapeutic relationship with them so that if they're using these controlled substances and they develop problems associated with them, that they feel comfortable approaching me
and
telling me.
What kind of problems are you talking about?
Problems that are associated with, say, misusing the medications, diverting the medications, having them stolen, using them more often than they should,
more often than they should. Dr. DuPont.
Yes, I think that's very important what Dr. Christo is saying. Patients who are taking these medicines as they're prescribed do not have any euphoria, are not sedated, are not in danger on the highway. They are perfectly functional. When people abuse these drugs, they take them in an entirely different fashion. They take much higher doses. They are very likely to use them by injection or by snorting them as opposed to taking them orally. And they often use it with other drugs of abuse, including alcohol, marijuana, and many other drugs. So it's an entirely different issue. And I want to bring up something that hasn't been mentioned, and that is the potential for abuse-resistant formulations. That is the ability to dispense opiate medications in formulations that are not, it's very difficult or impossible to inject or snort the medicines. And that discourages abuse of the medicines. And I think one of the things, without inhibiting the proper medical use, and I think one of the areas that is very, has a high potential for reducing non-medical use but not interfering with medical use is the encouragement of abuse-resistant formulations. And the FDA and others have been focused on when the medicines are used as indicated as their primary focus, and they need also to focus on when they're used in other ways and what can be done to discourage that.
Dr. Volkov.
Yeah, and I want to make another point because I think this is something that also has led to a lot of questioning. The sense that if you have pain and you're giving an opioid medication, you're not going to become addicted, and that is not completely correctly true. And so one of the issues that is very important for a physician prescribing opioid analgesics is to be aware of those that may be at higher risk of becoming addicted. And so this should not curtail the use of these medications, but it will mean that they would have to be followed more carefully. So who is at higher risk? Someone, for example, that had had a prior history of addiction, such as smoking or alcohol, in themselves or on their family. Another, those that are also at higher risk are adolescents. And interestingly, adolescents are prescribed opioid medications. The prescription patterns have actually doubled over the past 15 years. And they are prescribed opioid medications predominantly for dental procedures. And they are prescribed for them on a short period of time. But so it's when you are prescribed for short periods of time, you are unlikely to become addicted. And so that is not an issue. But when you are prescribing chronically opioid medications to adolescents, this is something that should be carefully thought about.
Dr. Christo, how does a drug like OxyContin or Vicodin work?
Well, these are, you know, termed opioid medications. They are, what they do is when you take a medication, say by mouth, that drug is absorbed. The active component, say, is, for example, oxycodone, then enters the bloodstream and binds then to what we call receptors, you know, in the nervous system. So, for example, in the spinal cord area, it's like a lock and key. So the OxyContin, for example, might be termed the lock and the key, and then the receptor would be termed the lock. So the oxycodone binds to the receptor, and then from there is a sort of a complex range of mechanisms that occur to help reduce pain at the spinal cord level and even at the brain level.
Yeah, I would think the brain would have to be involved somehow, but then if one takes such a medication for chronic pain, what are the side effects?
Well, there are side effects that we discuss with every patient who are going to be using these long term. And so the typical side effects can be constipation, nausea, vomiting, fatigue, drowsiness, and then others. Obviously, sort of addiction is one that a lot of my patients are concerned about. And it's fairly rare. I mean, the range, though, can be huge, somewhere between 3% to sometimes 40% has been documented in terms of the risk of addiction. Yet, I think overall and in my practice and those of others that I'm in communication with, I mean, we're looking at maybe 10%, 15% risk of addiction. But, you know, that is, I don't think we should focus necessarily on the risk of addiction. It's there, but it shouldn't be a reason to withhold these medications, as that previous emailer discussed.
Dr. DuPont, would you agree?
Yes, I think that's right. But I think the issue has to do with whether the person takes it as directed and the physician is informed. I saw a patient just 2 days ago, Diane, who was given Vicodin for a dental procedure, and that precipitated a relapse to alcoholism for the patient. Now, she didn't tell the doctor that she was an alcoholic. And that dentist who prescribed that would have no knowledge even now that she's relapsed to her alcoholism. But that is a serious risk. I think from the patient's concern, Dr. Christo was talking about the patient's worrying about addiction. One thing that they can be very clear of is the antidote to addiction is honesty. If the patient is honest with the physician and honest about the use of the medicines and other medicines, the risk of addiction is vanishingly small. What happens, though, is when the physician is not fully informed, oftentimes purposefully by the patient, to pursue an addiction, and that's very dangerous. So honesty is the antidote to addiction, and when a patient has an honest relationship with the physician, and the physician is well-trained, as Dr. Volkov is saying, the risk of addiction is very, very low.
Dr. Christo.
I wanted to add to Dr. DuPont's comments. In order to, let's say, ensure the honesty associated with the use of these medications, many prescribers of opioids use opioid agreements, right, that sort of describe the risks associated with using the particular medication, the consequences of misusing them, and that honesty element that Dr. DuPont is referring to is critical. We also do urine testing, you know, urine monitoring to ensure that what we're prescribing shows up in the urine and that other substances like marijuana, for example, or benzodiazepines or heroin do not. In other words, to ensure that those substances that they shouldn't be taking are not showing up in the urine.
Dr. Volkov.
Yeah, and that is very important. You can generate a contract with a patient, and particularly this should be considering those that are at higher risk. And among the other issues that need to be addressed, apart from those mentioned by Dr. Christo, is, for example, set up a series of expectations that the medication should do and evaluate it within a fixed period of time. And if that doesn't happen, then considering discontinuing medication. Another important aspect regarding the prescriptions of these medications is the importance of educating physicians to provide with the adequate number of pills, as opposed to sending you home with a much greater number of those that you would need and creating an excess of available medication that is unnecessary.
And that takes us to the next email from Tom, who's listening on Interlochen Public Radio. Please address the role of Florida pill mills in the distribution of prescription pain relievers and how the new Florida governor is standing in the way of attempts to reduce that role. Dr. DuPont.
I can't comment on what's going on in Florida, particularly with the governor, but I can say that the pill mills are a very serious problem.
What are they?
They're medical facilities. I get to call them pseudo-medical facilities that are set up simply to write prescriptions for opiate medications. And the physicians there virtually do nothing else but that. The patients come in, plunk down their cash money for the evaluation and the pills, and walk out with those pills. And they do this in tremendous quantities, many times taking the pills themselves because they're addicted, but also selling them and giving them away so that they become agents of spreading the addiction in the community, and the physicians play a central role in that. So stopping that is extremely important in terms of preventing addiction to these medicines.
Dr. Christo.
Let's not forget, too, Dr. Volkov mentioned this earlier on in the show, that there are other medications that we use to help treat pain aside from opioids that can be quite effective. Certain antidepressant medications, for example, can be quite useful. Anticonvulsant medications can be useful. And then a whole range of interventional procedures, nerve blocks, for example, that can help reduce pain.
Dr. Paul Christo, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Jenny, who's in Charlottesville, Virginia. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi. I've got two things I want to say. One, my mother, who was an alcoholic for most of my upbringing but had been sober for 25 years, got on the merry-go-round of antidepressants, anxieties, and pain meds that were just thrown at her like M&Ms. I mean, it was like anyone would write a script for her, including, like, physician assistants, you know. By the time she had many, many ER appointments, I mean, ER, you know, visits, and she was always saying she had strokes because she had to explain away her slurring and her staggering and her all that kind of stuff. And she, the last time she went to the ER, and it was like, oh, she had another stroke. My brother went to her house, cleared out all the prescriptions that she had been given in a 4-month period. There were 35 prescriptions. This woman weighed like maybe on a heavy day, 85 pounds. 35 prescriptions, all but two of them were for anxiety, antidepressants, and pain meds. Only two were actually legitimate medicines that she needed. And it was finally then that she actually was involuntarily committed, thank God, because she was near death for the past 7 years.
Wow, Dr. Volkov.
Well, I'm very sorry to hear the story of your mother, and I think that, unfortunately, it does highlight the improper management of cases like that are complex like the one of your mother. And it also highlights a big problem that we're observing, which is when physicians are prescribing some of these medications like opioid analgesics, they don't necessarily have information, or they don't inquire about the information that that patient may be taking other medications. And these combinations of medications can actually be quite dangerous and can exacerbate the medical presentation of the patients, but also can result in overdoses. So, and you're highlighting another aspect of it, which is the comorbidity of substance use disorders, in this case, alcoholism, with a wide variety of medical conditions, which actually makes the management of the patients harder, but nonetheless, one that should be addressed properly.
Dr. Christo.
What I do to help try to reduce this risk is, number one, to ensure that only one physician write the prescription opioids. So it's not going to be me and the primary care physician. It's going to be one of us only. And two, pill counts are helpful. So when patients come back to see me every month or two and I assess their use of opioids and functional state and quality of life, they're asked to please bring the bottle that contains the pills, and I count them physically to try to ensure anyway that they're using them properly. If I switch to a different opioid then, for example, we've started with OxyContin, and now I'm going to transition to a fentanyl patch, then I have the bottle of medications. And I then actually remove that bottle from them, give that bottle to the nurses. The nurses then have that bottle, that those medications destroyed. In other words, it reduces the volume of those prescription medications that that patient has.
Speaking of...
Diane, could I
make a point about this? Sure, go ahead, Dr. DuPont.
To go back to where we started with what ONDCP has put out, one of the things they are supporting is prescription drug monitoring programs. And if there was a prescription drug monitoring program, these multiple prescriptions would have been identified and there would have been a chance to intervene. The way it is now in many states, there is no way to do that, so that none of these prescribing doctors had any way of knowing that the other doctors were prescribing. So I think the ONDCP program for prescription drug monitoring across the country being very effective with these medicines is an extremely important public health step.
Dr. Robert DuPont, he's president of the Institute for Behavior and Health. He's former director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. When we come back, we'll hear from a police chief in Portsmouth, Ohio, who's dealing with this kind of abuse.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
More Diane Rehm Sunday is just ahead here on WAMU 88.5. It's 2:37.
Coming up Monday on the Kojo Namdi Show, raising expectations. First, with just 1% of Americans in the military, helping military families feel less isolated from their communities. Then, do students think paying top dollar for college entitles them to top marks? How an attitude of academic entitlement may be hurting universities. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon until 2, Monday on WAMU 88.5.
And welcome back. We're talking about addiction to pain-killing drugs. And joining us now is Police Chief Charles Horner. He's the chief of police in Portsmouth, Ohio. Good morning to you, Chief. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Dan. Thank you for the opportunity of being on your show and following such a distinguished panel.
Thank you. Can you talk about what's happening in your community?
Yes, we have, and I say we, I've been in law enforcement for about 28 years, of which 10 I commanded a local drug task force and have seen firsthand the epidemic that has developed within our community and the region and throughout the United States involving specifically opioid prescription medications. And I have occasionally described it as a tidal wave versus NAMI with no end in sight, basically, for our local communities. We saw some ripples as OxyContin was released. Well, actually, prior to that, MS Contin sulfate, or morphine sulfate, was released and used in the mid-90s and late 90s. We saw an incredible increase in the use of it prior to OxyContin. Around 2000, we saw a proliferation of OxyContin, and through early 2000s, we saw a gradual decline, and then with the settlement that Purdue Pharma had for the lawsuits against them and their improper promotion of their product, and I believe it was 2007, we saw a tremendous spike. And I think there's a correlation, obviously, with the profits that occurred following that settlement. And we're paying the price. OxyContin and Purdue Pharma, I think, laid a foundation for the abuse of a lot of the other drugs of abuse. You know, we are not seeing people die locally from heroin. We're not seeing people die from crack or hydrocodone. We're seeing the deaths that occur are being primarily related to OxyContin.
You've in fact had fatal overdoses more than quadrupled in your community.
We have, and it we've described it as an epidemic, and our local commissioner of health has declared a state of emergency or a health emergency for our county. And collectively, our community has pulled together a multidiscipline team to try to address the epidemic.
Chief Horner, what do you think is going on? Is it unemployment? Is it the economy? What is happening?
Well, I think Portsmouth, Ohio sets approximately 100 miles south of Columbus, probably 100 miles east of Cincinnati. Those are our closest DEA offices. And we're at the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. And I think history has shown that we, and I say we, Appalachia has been a specific area of emphasis for the distribution of OxyContin. And I think that the economy, I think everything contributes to a declining economic situation, health situation. You know, Sauter County itself is rated last in the healthiest counties in the state of Ohio. Mm. We have the highest hepatitis C rate, and we attribute that to intravenous use of drugs, specifically opioids. It's a crisis that, you know, collectively we have to deal with.
And what about the relationship between prescription drug abuse and crime? What are you seeing there?
In discussions with authorities throughout the state and local, we believe that 85 to 90% of crime either indirectly or directly is related to prescription medication abuse.
Dr. Christo.
Chief Horner, my understanding of the problem in that area is that essentially that people are getting opioids from these sort of drug mills rather than using them for legitimate medical purposes and obtaining them from pain physicians or physicians in general. Is that what your understanding is?
Clearly, the bulk of the prescription medications are coming from pill mills. Obviously, the Florida connection, that being law enforcement described as the OxyContin Express. I think that 90% of opioids distributed throughout the United States are attributed to Florida distribution. And thirdly, we have crack dealers that are taking and distributing, moving from the sale and distribution of crack cocaine to sale and distribution of OxyContin, and specifically out of the Detroit, Michigan area.
Dr. Volkoff.
Yeah, and this is a very unfortunate situation that in a way mimics what's happening in the rest of the United States. And so we've been trying to identify what are the factors that are driving the epidemic of opioid analgesics. One of them is the increase in availability, and the prescription of hydrocodone and oxycodone products has quadrupled over a 20-year period. And who are at greater risk? Those that are 18 to 25 years of age, and followed by those that are 12 to 18 years old. How are they getting their medication? These drugs, and that's one of the questions that's very relevant in order to do prevention. Most of them report that they are getting them from friends or relatives that either give them to them for free or sell them. Mm. Interestingly, among adolescents, 30% of them are getting them from their own prescription. So the extent, and this is very different from the way that you actually get other drugs, and highlights again the crucial importance of educating physicians in the proper prescription practices for opioid analgesics to obviate the great availability of medications that we have, while at the same time protecting the right of patients suffering from pain to have access to these very valuable medications.
And Chief Horner, one other thing that was pointed out in the recent New York Times article that focused on your community is that 1 in 10 babies born last year tested positive for drugs. That means you've got second and even third generations born addicted.
Yes, unfortunately, that's true.
Diane, a point that I think is important, the question of why this is happening. One is that these medicines or these chemicals are very reinforcing. People like them. They are very attractive on a purely biological basis without any reference to any culture or any particular character.
What does that mean, Dr. DuPont?
You can show this with animals, that they like to get these chemicals because they produce brain reward. We're talking about prescription drugs, and that's confusing to many in the audience, I think, because it's really not prescription drugs as a whole. It's a very small segment of the prescription drugs, and those are substances that are called controlled substances because they are specific chemicals that produce brain reward. Dr. Volkoff is one of the leading scientists in the world in studying how this works, but it's clear that it happens on a purely biological basis. But let me also say, the other thing is, think about the fact that when a patient walks out of the doctor's office, a single daily dose can be sold on the street for $100. So if a person comes out with a prescription for 30 pills, that's $3,000 that they've got worth just to pass it on to somebody else. You think about how many people are attracted to those economics, never mind the biology of it, and you get some idea of the potential for this as a major public health threat.
Dr. Volkoff.
And there is also another point that is apparently contributing to the favoring of opioid analgesics as drugs of abuse and diversion, and that is the misguided belief by those abusing it that they are safer than traditional illicit substances because, after all, they are being prescribed by physicians. So the sense is if these medications are prescribed by physicians, they cannot be so dangerous, which is very inaccurate because when improperly taken, they are as dangerous as any of the illicit substances.
All right, to Mountains, Oklahoma. Good morning, David.
Good morning to you. And I just want to echo a point that was just made. And there are some similarities and some differences that I hear, and I'm a former heroin addict. The differences are, to echo that point, is that people think that because they're prescribed by a doctor that for some reason it's quote-unquote cleaner. The similarities are is that people were talking earlier about the euphoric effects, and that's why people do that at first. But once the onset of addiction has occurred, then people do these drugs because they have to, because that's what they need to stay well. So that's why there's such a demand, and that's why there's such abuse, and that's why people are willing to go to almost any extent to get them. And that's very reminiscent of the heroin thing. And then the final point I will make is not only are people that use these in physical pain, but they are in emotional and spiritual pain as well. And those are the points I want to make.
Dr. Christel.
That element of emotional pain, I think, is often neglected, and I'm glad you brought that point up because having pain is not just a physical experience. It's very emotional. It can lead to demoralization and isolation and depression, and I think that often we miss that element in treating patients, and I think it's important for us to reach out to our colleagues in psychiatry and in psychology to help bring them on board in terms of treating patients who have chronic pain.
And let's go to Don, who's in Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Diane. I'd just like to say that for the most part, I pretty strongly disagree with a lot of what your panel is saying, and I'm really over the idea that those of us who need a medication, whether it be an opioid or a pseudoephedrine or what have you, should pay for the misuse and basically stupidity of others. I'm in chronic pain. I cannot get a doctor here in North Carolina where I live to write me the sort of prescription that I really need. And all I could say is thank God for the pill mills because I've been to them more than once and I'm going to go back again.
Dr. Volkoff.
Yeah, and I'm very sorry that you've been denied access to proper management of your pain. The reality, No, and there are two things, and they are not exclusive. The notion that there are patients that are suffering from pain that are all medicated, that does not negate, nor is it exclusive at the same time, with the other reality that pain medications with opioids are also overprescribed. And again, the improper education leads physicians to be afraid of prescribing opioid analgesics to patients that need them, while at the same time it may lead other physicians to overprescribe opioid analgesics without realizing that they are unnecessary for that particular type of pain.
Dr. Christo.
I'd like the caller to also remember that there are non-opioids that can be helpful, and maybe you've tried them, but things like certain antidepressants can help.
Many of those medications are as dangerous or more dangerous than the opioids. Look at the liver damage that can result from using acetaminophen, for instance. It's crazy. I don't get it. Long-term therapy on a lot of non-opioids or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs is not good for you.
Yeah, and I think that that's why I started my first comment is we really need more research for the development of more effective medications for chronic pain.
Dr. Nora Volkov, she's director of the NIH's National Institute on Drug Abuse, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to a caller in Mariana, Florida. Good morning, Joe.
Morning. I'd just like to make a comment that I really don't have any control over. But has our current administration exhibited any optimistic desire of addressing and eliminating the overkill of legal drug pushers, misuse of the media, and holding them accountable some way, just like we are currently holding BP accountable for an accident?
Dr. DuPont, what about drug ads?
Well, I think that go back to what Dr. Christo and Dr. Volkov are saying, that there's a problem here because there really is a need for better treatment of pain. And I think there is a point to the widespread use of these medicines. On the other hand, I think what has been missing from much of the discussion is the recognition of the high rate of non-medical use of these, estimated at something like 20% of all of these pills that are prescribed are used non-medically. That is a huge problem. And I think that has not been adequately addressed. And I think it needs to be addressed also by the manufacturers. But I think what happened with ONDCP on Tuesday was a major step in that direction to, as I said at the beginning, to change our national thinking about these drugs and to recognize the very serious problem with non-medical use that is measured in deaths, is measured in emergency room visits, and measured in addiction. And that needs to be factored into this equation, and it's not going to be simple.
All right. Finally, to Southwest Virginia. Good morning, Steve.
Yes, my question, I was going to comment. I'm a trucker, and I'm down here in the streets. And what's going on where I live is my sister-in-law sells half her pills, her daughter does. But what I'm trying to tell people, if OxyContin's worth $100 a pill, you got 60, that's $6,000. You wouldn't leave $6,000 in a cabinet somewhere. You have to lock this dope up. Your mother, your sister, your next-door neighbor would sneak over and get two pills at a time.
Chief Horner.
I agree. Medicine cabinets are a tremendous source of prescriptions or drugs of abuse getting onto the street and impacting the drug abuse situation in our county. The cost, I think it's important to point out that the cost, the previous caller indicated that we shouldn't be funding this. We should be funding this, and the reason being is in Ohio alone, I think it was estimated that the cost to the state of Ohio was something like $3 billion. The ramifications of dealing with this drug problem, this drug epidemic, in a time when the state of Ohio has a deficit and local communities have a deficit, $3 billion goes a long way.
Dr. Christo.
I do ask my patients to purchase lockboxes if I'm prescribing opioids or other controlled substances to them. I think it's important that I educate them on the need to keep them controlled and in a safe place so that diversion is reduced. I mean, I've had some patients who've told me that, for example, they've had construction workers come to their house and steal their medications that were out on the cabinet, for example, or in the bathroom.
But it's also kids.
Yes, and just to get an idea to the, your public at what the numbers are, 12th graders have reported 8 to 10% in the past year abuse of hydrocodone and 5% abuse of Vicodin.
Dr. Nora Volkoff, she is director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse. Also, Dr. Paul Christo of Johns Hopkins University, and Robert DuPont, he's former director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and Charles Horner, chief of police at the Portsmouth Police Department in Ohio. Thank you all. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rainey.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Aetna Foundation, committed to promoting wellness, health, and access to high-quality health care for everyone. Learn more at aetnafoundation.org. From Cabot Creamery Cooperative, makers of naturally aged Vermont cheddar cheese, and offering recipes, stories, and programs for schools at cabotcheese.coop. And from Sitter City, connecting families to local babysitters and nannies with photos, background checks, and reviews. More at sittercity.com. This is NPR.
Hi there, I'm Rebecca Shear, host of WAMU 88.5's Metro Connection, and welcome to Door to Door, our weekly trip around the region. Today we swing by Shirlington, Virginia, and then we head to Fort DuPont in southeast D.C.
Hi, I'm Christian Dorsey, and I'm a resident of Shirlington, a neighborhood in Arlington, Virginia. Because it's not on a metro stop, it's really kind of invisible to a lot of people. But if you're heading from downtown D.C. and you're crossing the 14th Street Bridge and heading on 395 South, it is one of the early exits into Arlington. It's really kind of a cool success story. People who lived in Shirlington 30 years ago remember, a big box store, really not much else. And over the course of the last 30 years, we had a concerted planning effort. And what was once a one-block strip has now more than doubled. I mean, just to give you a sense, you've got basic chain fare, but you're also going to get something interesting like Bus Boys and Poets, Cake Love. About 700 apartment or condominium units, a hotel, a grocery store, which the neighborhood didn't have before, and just all kinds of nonprofit, arts-oriented institutions. We've had a lot that's happened pretty quickly.
My name is Jermaine Robinson, and I'm from Fort DuPont in southeast Washington, D.C., and I'm 23 years old. When you say Fort DuPont, you think Fort DuPont concerts. My first experience coming to Fort DuPont Park was with my grandfather to come see Roy Ayers when I was about 1 year old. And through him, I got connected to this community. Fort DuPont, outside of the park, it's unorganized. I feel like for a community to be great, you have to be organized. I say you have your parts, like you have your hardworking people that want change. Or you have your parts where you just don't want to be because there's drug activity or people who don't want to conform to basic law.